Welcome to Sex Ed with DB. I'm your host, DB. Let's get into it. Magic Wand's story begins in 1968, a full year before we landed on the moon and about 6 months before bell bottoms were trendy the first time. This is when the Magic Wand, the original personal massager, was first introduced, and I am so glad it was. No one expected that this unassuming device would soon become one of the world's most recognizable products. The Magic Wand original exemplifies the phrase icon, and now it shares the spotlight with three equally impressive models: Magic Wand Plus, a corded variable speed massager, Magic Wand Rechargeable, a cordless multifunction device, and the first ever Magic Wand Mini, a new, compact, adorable, rechargeable massager. Every product that bears the Magic Wand name features the legendary power and historic pleasure that took the world by storm more than half a century ago. My personal favorite Magic Wand is the original. They sell millions every year, and for good reason. It's powerful and brings so much pleasure in all the right places. Want to get a discount on this amazing powerhouse? Go to sexedwithdb.com/magicwand to learn more. I'm about to get personal here, so listen up. I'm going to tell you a fun fact about me that you definitely didn't know. The lube that I use most consistently is Uberlube. I really mean it. If you were here with me right now, I'd tell you to go over to my nightstand drawer and tell me what you see. That's right, you would see a bottle of Uberlube. If you've never heard of Uberlube, let me tell you about it. Uberlube is a silky smooth silicone-based lube recommended by leading doctors, and its body-friendly ingredient list makes it widely used by people with sensitivities to lubricants. Another amazing thing about Uberlube is that it doesn't leave a sticky residue like water-based lubes do. It lasts for a long time and doesn't stain clothing or bedding. I have 3 bottles of Uberlube on my bedside table right now, ready when I need it. If you're someone who wants to feel more pleasure in the bedroom, use code SEXEDWITHDB for 15% off at uberlube.com. Trust me, it's amazing. Are you falling into a pattern with your partner? Looking to spice things up but aren't sure how? Me and my partner exit our ordinary with Lion's Den. Lion's Den has hundreds of your favorite brands to help you and your partner reconnect or try something new. From novices to dungeon masters, there are products for every comfort level. With 50 plus years in business, Lion's Den is here to help. Can't make it to a local store? Shop online and chat with a customer service team member while you shop. Lion's Den offers our listeners 15% off in-store and online using code SEXEDWITHDB at lionsden.com.
Ever feel like the wellness landscape is missing something and that conversations are very one-size-fits-all and that the conversations don't necessarily apply to your experiences? Hi, I'm Dr. Cassandra Dunbar, the host of the Be Well Sis podcast. Be Well Sis explores everything from hormonal health to aging to relationships and everything in between. The Be Well Sis podcast is your home for insightful conversations with incredibly inspiring women from all walks of life. Join us every week and tune into an episode that is crafted to help you thrive physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. The Be Well Sis podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. Be Well Sis.
Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I am so excited about today's guest. It is the wonderful Dr. Justin Lee Miller that we have on today. Dr. Justin Lee Miller is a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute, legendary. He runs the Sex and Psychology blog and podcast, which I have been on. If you have missed my episode of the Sex and Psychology podcast, I highly recommend after this episode you go and listen to it. I was actually on 2 different episodes. He is such a great interviewer, and I just love chatting with him, and so highly recommend that. He is also the author of the popular book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Dr. Lee Miller is an award-winning educator and prolific researcher who has published more than 50 academic works, including a textbook titled The Psychology of Human Sexuality that is used in college classrooms around the world. So fucking cool to get to know him and interview him. And in this episode, we talk all about the potential of sexting, the most popular and most surprising sexual fantasies, and how sexual fantasies can help strengthen relationships. I really, really enjoyed this episode. I'm sure you will too. He is so smart and so interesting, and this is just fire content, so I can't wait for you to hear it. Here I am with Dr. Justin Lee Miller. Hello, Justin. How's it going today?
Great. Hi, DB. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely honored to have you on the pod. I had such a great time on your podcast when I was on many months ago, it seems, but who knows what is time. but I'm really, really glad to have you on today to talk all about your book and all about your research. And yeah, you're just a fucking baller, if I may. And so I'm excited to interview you and talk to you. But first and foremost, we have to do the quick and dirty, which are three get to know you questions. I will also answer them. I have not seen these before. And so I'm excited to hear from you some of your thoughts and feelings on these. But number one, sexting, overrated or underrated? What do you think?
I mean, I guess I would say, based on kind of like the media discourse that's out there about sexting, I would say it's probably underrated because we hear so much about it that frames it as, you know, this risky thing and bad things that can happen as a result of it. And, you know, certainly there are context situations in which that can be true. But I think a lot of people don't realize the full potential of sexting because they might have pretty narrow ideas about what it is or what it can be and how it can be used in a relationship. And I think if you use it in the right way, a way that works for you and your partner or partners, depending on your situation, it can be a great way to connect, to have deeper conversations, to flirt, to build up anticipation for sex. So yeah, I think it's probably underrated.
Love it. I totally agree. I think generally speaking, the first thing, unfortunately, that comes to mind for people when it comes to sexting is just unsolicited dick pics, which is kind of like, that's not all it can be. I really like the piece that you said about anticipation of kind of like, ooh, I'm at work, but like, what are you wearing? And like, you know, building up that kind of energy for maybe later when you're both home or when you're all home. And yeah, I think that there's, you know, maybe people also think of just like emojis or eggplants, but I think that generally speaking, it has a lot of potential and can be used more to really get it, people excited.
And, you know, there actually is some research, believe it or not, that suggests that people who use more emojis have more sex. So maybe there is something to that idea.
Wait. We need to pause there. What do you think is behind that? What do you think is there?
Well, what we think might be going on is that people who use more emojis might just be more emotionally expressive in general, and the emojis might be adding more character or nuance or depth to the text messages, because we know that when you're communicating with people online, that it's very easy for things to be misinterpreted. And sometimes adding an emoji can kind of clarify what the intent or feel is behind that message. So maybe that's what's going on.
Love it. I personally do really like to use a lot of emojis, so I'm taking this personally in a good way. Awesome. Love that we're diving right in with that research right off the bat. Second question, what is one thing that you wish, I know that there are a million probably, but if you could say one thing that you wish everyone learned in sex ed growing up, what would that be?
I mean, you're right. There are a million things that I could list there. So I guess if we were just going to go with one thing, it might be that sex isn't just one thing, because many of us learn that sex is just penis and vagina intercourse, often with the caveat that it's within a monogamous marriage for the purpose of procreation. And when people have those very narrow ideas of what sex is, it can make it harder for us to find sexual fulfillment and ways to connect. Also, different people enjoy connecting in different kinds of ways. What we enjoy from sex at different points in our lives can vary based on how our bodies might be changing and other things like that. So having a more expansive definition of sex, I think, is a really good place to start.
Love it. So incredibly important. I will add on to that by saying, like, the message that your body is perfect the way it is and anyone else who tells you otherwise is probably trying to get you to buy something would be like my version of what I wish everyone knew. There's so much insecurity about people's bodies that people have, and this idea that other people are hotter or, you know, more strong or tan or like whatever kind of social media is, the lies that we're receiving from that. And the more that we love our bodies and can get used to our own skin and feeling good in it, then the more confident that we are, the more pleasure we can have and happiness that we can have in our lives. So that's probably where I would aim right now. But yeah, again, this is the hardest question. There are like 9 trillion things because our sex ed generally sucks in this country. So a lot that we could teach and wish that people learned. And the third question for the quick and dirty that we have is, what is your go-to communication tip for improving intimacy?
So it's sort of multi-pronged, right? So I think when it comes to talking about improving your sex life or intimate life with a partner, one is to really kind of pick your time and place carefully. And especially if it's something that could be perceived as critical, you know, that maybe you want your partner to do something different in bed, maybe don't bring that up in the middle of sex. You know, maybe find the right time to kind of disclose that, to talk about it with your partner, and don't frame it in a way that is critical, because that's where conversations about sex just go off the rails. So you want to start first with some type of compliment or validation for your partner, letting them know that you find them to be attractive and you enjoy the sex that you're having together, and then frame it as, here's something different that I might like to try, and here's what I think might be hot about that. And by taking that approach, that makes it much more likely that your partner will be receptive to it and that you're going to get what you want. Because if you just, you know, stop, say, in the middle of sex and say you're doing it wrong, that's not really going to go well.
Yeah, I would not feel great if I received that information during that time. Yeah, timing truly is everything. I feel like mine would probably be around like body language, like knowing that your body language and the way that you interpret other people's body language really means something. And we can learn just as much about people when it comes to how we're seeing how their arms are folded or how they're down, how they're guarded or how they're not. So I do think like really taking note of your partner or partner's body language can really be helpful in understanding some signs as to what they're feeling and what they're thinking. Well, that was the quick and dirty. Thank you for participating in those intro questions. And now let's get into the meat and potatoes here. That's not what this segment is called. This is just the interview. But
the meat. Let's just call it the meat.
The meat. I love it. Let's talk about your research and your book. So you dove into a lot of fascinating research on sexual fantasies for your book, Tell Me What You Want, very hot title, by the way, The Science of Sexual Desire, right? So in doing this research, I wonder, have you ever stumbled upon a story or a case study that really like completely caught you off guard, even as a really, you know, vet researcher? Like, is there something that you didn't expect to find at all, but maybe something that ended up really revealing something profound about human sexuality that sticks with you?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of ways to answer that question. And, you know, one is, I often get asked, did I learn about any new sexual fantasies when I was conducting this work? And I surveyed more than 4,000 people from all over the United States. And I will say, most of the fantasies weren't like a big surprise to me as somebody who's worked in the space for quite some time. But there was one fantasy that I always go to that was new to me that I had just never heard of before. And that was the human cow fantasy, or HuCow for short, right? This was a woman who described her fantasy as being tied up in the center of town and being force-fed hormones so that she would lactate continuously and people could come and milk her and have sex with her whenever they wanted. So it's a fantasy that has themes and elements of dominance and submission and erotic lactation. And there's also kind of an impregnation fetish that kind of goes along with it. And so that was new to me. And it turns out that it's not a new fantasy, right? I did some digging and research afterwards and found out that other people do have this fantasy. You can find hundreds of HuCow erotic novels on Amazon. You can
find hundreds.
You can find thousands of HuCow porn videos on some of the big tube sites. So, you know, I would consider it to be kind of a niche sexual interest. You know, it doesn't seem to be super common, but other people do have it. And that was one of the things that I learned about in the process of this work.
Love it. I mean, is there kind of more information that you gather from these folks as to where you think, well, I'm sure all sexual fantasies come from, you know, childhood or just other experiences. I mean, you're the researcher. Maybe I should stop there. Where do fantasies come from for people? And like, are these common themes just kind of further proof that we are more similar than we are different?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And when you look at something like a Hugh Cal fantasy, on the surface, that might sound very unusual to a lot of people. But when you start breaking it down into core themes, including things like dominance and submission, that's actually one of the most popular themes in people's sexual fantasies. One of the big things people get turned on by is this idea of some kind of consensual power exchange and taking on different roles, whether that's being more dominant than you are in reality or more submissive, or maybe it's switching back and forth between different roles. And in our fantasies, we often just get very creative in the way that we express this. And so in the case of something like a Hugh Cow fantasy, it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody literally wants to become a cow, right? It might reflect this deeper theme or desire for consensual power exchange. And when you start to look at, well, where do these different desires come from? Where do our fantasies come from? Well, our fantasies are complex and multifaceted. So I describe them as being a biopsychosocial phenomenon. So there are biological factors, psychological factors, and sociocultural factors that all play a role. So I'll give you a quick example of one of each of those factors.
Please, yeah.
So if you look at something like biological factors, well, the sex hormones, the level of hormones we have in our body is actually linked to the amount and frequency of sexual fantasies that we have, right? So, you know, that is one biological contributor to our fantasies, is that if your hormone levels are higher, you're likely to have more of these fantasies. And if they're lower, you're likely to have less. In terms of a psychological factor, our personalities and our attachment styles are pretty big predictors of the kinds of things that we tend to fantasize about. So for example, if you're somebody who's very extroverted and outgoing in real life, you tend to be pretty extroverted and outgoing in your fantasies, right? So that can include having more multi-partner fantasies or more non-monogamy fantasies. Likewise, if you're somebody who maybe has kind of an insecure attachment style, specifically if you're high on attachment anxiety, your fantasies often revolve around ways of kind of playing it safe when it comes to sex, so as to avoid triggering that insecurity or that attachment threat. And then lastly, if we look at like sociocultural factors, one that quickly comes to mind for me would be if you look at the COVID pandemic and how that affected people's fantasies. You know, I did research when we were in that lockdown period of what was happening with our fantasies during that period in time. And one of the interesting things I found was that people had more fantasies about passion and romance during that period when we couldn't go out and interact with the world in the way that we could before. And to me, that says when we have constraints socially that are placed on our ability to meet our intimate needs, that wanting to connect with other people and to feel desired, that we might sometimes turn to our fantasies to compensate for that.
That makes a ton of sense. Wow. That's fantastic. I mean, yeah, you're really, really fantastic at explaining this because it's your research and because you teach on it. But yeah, I think what's interesting to me about the personality example that you shared is I would have kind of imagined that it would maybe be the opposite. Like if I'm someone who's super extroverted, then maybe my fantasies would be a little bit more introverted because it's like another side of the coin. When you find that people say are more extroverted, and you said they're more likely to have kind of these extroverted fantasies, is there maybe like a piece that that shows up that maybe isn't meeting their personality and they are maybe wanting to be a little, you know, like if they're dominant more in real life, would their fantasies maybe be a little bit more submissive? Or you know what I'm trying to get at here?
Yeah. And it's a popular idea that's out there that our fantasies are escape, right? And that we become different people in our fantasies than we are in reality to maybe relieve some of that burden. And, you know, there is some truth to that. You know, some people do change themselves or their personalities a lot in their sexual fantasies, but other people don't change themselves at all. And who they are in their fantasy very closely mirrors or parallels who they are in reality. So I think what I would say to this is that, you know, when you try to look at how personality is associated with fantasy, yes, you can find these overall what we call main effects where this personality trait is correlated with this type of fantasy, but you have to remember there's always individual variability. You know, it's not a perfect correlation in the sense that, you know, everybody doesn't experience the same thing, but our personalities also exist in combination with a variety of traits. So somebody who is high in extroversion, well, that's just one of many traits that they have. And we also need to look at how are they on something like their openness to experience? What is their personality like when it comes to their level of agreeableness or conscientiousness or neuroticism? And so it's really the combination of all of these traits that's important to take into account. And that's why, you know, for example, two people could be high on extroversion, but have very different types of fantasies, but it might be because their other personality traits are very different from one another.
Mm. So interesting. This is really good stuff. Very fascinating. My next question is about someone's relationship when it comes to sexual fantasies. Like, can you share a story or example where exploring and embracing sexual fantasies has really transformed a relationship for the better? Because I feel like there are kind of rumors and kind of these myths out there when it comes to, oh, sexual fantasies, you know, that's cheating, or that's something that, you know, is really harmful if you're in a monogamous relationship, or things of that nature. But it really seems like fantasy can be such a powerful tool for connection. So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I can give you two examples. I can tell you what I found in my own research, and then I can tell you what I've heard from people who have read my book. So if I start first with what has been reader response or reaction to my work on sexual fantasies, I can't tell you how many people who have written to me personally who have said, your book inspired me to talk about or share my fantasies with my partner. And then we decided to act on this fantasy and we both had this great experience and it brought us closer and our relationship is stronger than ever. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing there, but I've heard things that are similar to that from multiple people who have found that the information I shared was useful to them. And it was that sort of impetus or springboard they needed to really talk about fantasies for the first time in their life. And similar to that, I've also heard from a lot of people who've said that, you know, reading your work made me feel normal for the first time in my life, because I thought I was the only person who had that fantasy. And I thought that there was something wrong with me. And so, you know, something that a lot of people don't realize is that literally 80 to 90% of sexual problems can be solved with sex education, you know, because so much of our anxiety, insecurity, so many of our difficulties when it comes to sex just stem from not knowing what is normal about our own bodies or about sex or how to approach it, or just having some myths or misconceptions that we're holding that are harmful. So yeah, I mean, that's one of the most gratifying things about doing the work is then hearing from people who found it to be useful. And then the other thing I would say is based on my own research, you know, I've asked people what has happened when you share a fantasy with a partner, what has happened when you acted on a fantasy with a partner, what were your experiences like? And for the most part, people report positive experiences. That's not to say that everyone has a positive experience, but when it comes to sharing a fantasy with a partner, by and large, you know, like 3/4 or so of people I've surveyed say that it improved their relationship, it brought them closer, it helped them to develop more trust and intimacy in their relationship. And if you look at acting on a fantasy, it's still a majority who say similar things, but it's lower. And I think that makes sense because sharing a fantasy and acting on a fantasy are two totally different things. You know, sharing a fantasy is self-disclosure. It can be a form of dirty talk. That's one thing. Acting on a fantasy throws a bunch of other variables into the mix, and it depends on what kind of fantasy it is.
Like, if I'm doing like a medieval thing, there's like a whole lot of things we need to get, you know, a lot of props, etc.
Right. There are more things that can potentially go wrong. If you're bringing other people into the mix, like if it's a threesome or a swinging kind of fantasy, there's the potential for unexpected emotions to arise. Mm. You know, I'm a social psychologist, and one of the things we know is that when people try to predict their future emotional states, they're pretty shitty at doing so, right? So if you think about something like a sexual fantasy, like in your mind, it sounds great. And you think like, oh, when I do that, it's going to be so hot and I'm going to be so horny and turned on and it's going to be great and we're going to love it. And then you might get in that situation and you're like, oh, I have some unexpected feelings that are popping up for me, or this didn't quite go according to plan. And then that kind of dampens your enthusiasm. And so, you know, there's kind of this reality check that you need to have when it comes to acting on fantasies, is to step back and realize like everything might not go exactly as you think it's going to go in your head. some things might not go according to plan. And sometimes it takes practice to perfect a fantasy.
Totally. And like, even with masturbation and sexual fantasies, like, that's also okay if you want to keep that for yourself, like for a way for you to kind of get into the mood without your partner when you're just kind of excited by yourself. And I think that people shouldn't lose that imagination when they're in partnership, or shouldn't have to feel like, oh, I need to share these sexual fantasies, right? It's like your partner doesn't need to have access to every single thing in your head. But if you do want to share something with them that's exciting, or that you want to try with them, or just as a way to connect with them, then that's great too.
Yeah. I mean, there are benefits to sharing fantasies with a partner, but that doesn't mean that you have to share fantasies with a partner. And it doesn't mean you have to share every fantasy you've ever had with a partner. You know, before you get to that point of sharing fantasies, it's step back and ask, well, why do I want to share this fantasy with a partner? Is it because I want them to better understand me as a sexual person? Is it because I think it would just be hot for us to share fantasies and use that as a form of dirty talk and to enhance arousal that way? Or is it because, you know, I have this fantasy and I'm curious about exploring it, and I want to see if my partner will explore it with me? You know, those are all kind of different considerations. And so just think about, what are your reasons for wanting to share the fantasy in the first place?
Totally. Let's talk about porn, shall we? So porn's impact on society and our sex lives is a hot topic generally, I would say. But at Sex Ed with DB, we're really curious about the nuances that might be missing from typical conversations about porn. And we talk about porn all the time. And I wonder if you can walk us through a study or a finding that really challenged the way that we typically think about porn's influence on sexual attitudes and behaviors, i.e. porn is terrible, porn doesn't offer any benefits, etc.
Yeah, you know, I would start by saying that porn is neither inherently good nor inherently bad, you know, and the truth about porn and how it affects us is that it's complex and highly nuanced. It depends on the person who is interacting with the porn, and it depends on the type of porn that they're consuming, right? It's ultimately about that interaction between the person and their environment when you want to try to predict what the effects of pornography are likely to be. And what we see in the data is that, you know, it's a mixed bag, right? Some people report very negative effects of pornography in their lives. Some people report very positive effects, and some people are, you know, somewhere in the middle where maybe it's a mix of positive and negative, or maybe it just doesn't have any strong effects one way or another, right? So it's not the case that porn just has this one effect on all people in all situations. Like, that is a big myth about porn. So in terms of what are some studies that have challenged our assumptions, well, one that comes to mind quickly for me that I think is interesting is that, you know, there's this idea, this narrative out there about porn being addictive, right? And that it operates similar to drug addictions and alcohol addictions. And so people often apply the addiction model to porn and say, well, if you're watching porn, then that's going to lead to a tolerance effect, right? Where over time, you're going to need to watch more and more of it, or you're going to need to watch more extreme kinds of porn over time. And what we see in the data that's tested whether or not there's a tolerance effect here is that it doesn't really exist. It doesn't happen, right? That people don't necessarily progress to more porn and more intense porn over time. And in fact, something that's really interesting in this research is that they find that for people who are watchers or consumers of more intense kinds of porn, they actually seem to be more sexually sensitive, like neurologically, to all kinds of sexual stimuli. So it's not that they're only aroused by really extreme porn, they're kind of aroused by all porn, no matter where it falls on the spectrum. And so, you know, this idea that porn necessarily builds up this tolerance and you're going to need more and more extreme content over time just isn't supported by the data. And when you look at data testing other aspects of this addiction model, it just doesn't really pan out. Like, porn doesn't seem to be addictive in the way that substances are. That's not to say that people can't have problems with their porn use, but that addiction isn't necessarily the right model for it. And I think in some cases, when people have problematic pornography use, a better way to think of it is that it might be a compulsion, and it might be related to something like OCD, or it might be related to some kind of underlying anxiety or mood disorder where they're turning to sex as a way of regulating their own emotional states. You know, that's one of the things I found really interesting about how mental health is related to sexual behavior in general is that if you look at something like depression, you know, there's this common idea that depression lowers libido. It makes us less interested in sex. But what we see is that depressed people, clinically depressed people, show one of two effects. One is that it either lowers libido, or another is that it actually really raises libido and they might engage in more extreme and more intense sexual behaviors.
Hypersexual behavior.
Yeah. And it's more a way of just self-regulating their mood state, right? And so when we start learning about and seeing things like that, it's like, okay, so is sex or porn really the problem? Or is there something else that's going on that we need to be looking at? I think the issue is that porn is just easy to blame, right? It's easy to say porn is bad. But it really oversimplifies the story because it's usually not the porn itself that's the problem. There's something else underlying it when it's linked to these negative outcomes.
So interesting. I hadn't even heard the piece on maybe like the hypersexual behaviors for people with depression, because you don't really hear about that part. You really mainly hear about people with low libidos. So that is really fascinating. And I haven't heard this kind of connection also, or kind of this comparison to it maybe being a compulsion rather than an addiction. And I wonder, like, in terms of like how we get people to listen to that, to the fact that the addiction model doesn't work, like, how do you think we can get the word out about that? Because I just feel like even the layperson who's like pretty informed and like, you know, say is pretty liberal or kind of like a thinker that doesn't necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily think that, oh, they hate porn or they think it's terrible, you know, I have heard those kinds of things from people that I wouldn't expect. So I wonder what is the way to kind of like open up their minds and kind of like ensure that we're getting this message out about porn?
Well, I think one is that we kind of need to be a little bit more careful about how we throw the term addiction around in everyday life, because we kind of refer to everything as an addiction these days. And once everything is an addiction, then nothing is an addiction, you know, because the term ceases to lose all meaning. And so, you know, part of it is just like, maybe we don't really know what we're talking about when we call something an addiction or not, because we're just using it in this very casual way. But something that I think is a good and helpful point for framing discussions around pornography addiction is that if you look in studies where people are self-described porn addicts and you look at the average amount of time that they spend per week watching porn, some studies have found that it's 15 minutes per week of porn exposure, right? And we're calling 15 minutes a week an addiction, right? Because when people hear the term porn addiction, they might be thinking, well, they're spending hours a day every day and all these other sorts of things. Now, by contrast, if you look at what is the average amount of TV or Netflix that people watch per day, you know, it can be 3 hours
minimum,
or longer, right? And it's like, we don't consider that to be an addiction, right? You know, that's consuming media, but you're consuming it in a much greater quantity. We're not calling that an addiction, but we're calling that 15 minutes a week an addiction. Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on there? And that gets at another issue that's related to when people talk about pornography addiction, is that oftentimes there is some kind of like moral incongruence where people are uncomfortable with their own viewing of porn because they've internalized the message that porn is bad.
Right.
And so they think that watching porn in any quantity, even if it's only a few minutes a week, is a bad thing because they're not living up to their own moral values, or because they think that watching porn makes them complicit in something bad sexually. So I think a lot of what's happening when people talk about porn as an addiction is that we're just kind of blaming the porn again without dealing with kind of like the underlying anxieties and sometimes shame about sexuality that leads us to view porn through this negative lens.
Here are my top three favorite things I love about Uberlube. Number one, Uberlube makes sex feel a lot more pleasurable. It's as simple yet as powerful as that. Number two, Uberlube is recommended by leading doctors, and its body-friendly ingredient list is widely used by people with sensitivities to lubricants. And number three, Uberlube will not stain clothing or bedding. Any spills can be easily cleaned with detergent and water. Get your bottle of Uberlube now with code SEXEDWITHDB for 15% off at uberlube.com. Ever since getting engaged to my wonderful fiance, I've been thinking about ways to keep things fun and novel between us. But I, of course, want it to feel organic. I want to be able to feel sexy and comfortable in my body while trying something new. Thanks to Lion's Den, a new adventure I've been exploring is the world of lingerie. I never really was a big lingerie girl myself, but once I started trying on lingerie that accentuated my curves, felt super soft to the touch, and made me look in the mirror and felt wildly confident in my skin, that changed pretty quickly. Plus, when I searched for what I might like on Lion's Den's website, I saw models that actually looked like me. They were curvy and thick and voluptuous, and it made all the difference to see models that have my body type. Want to join me in my new lingerie chapter? Right now, you can use code SEXEDWITHDB for 15% off your purchase in-store and online at lionsden.com. Follow them on social media at Lion's Den Adult on IG and TikTok for exclusive offers, deals, and giveaways.
I'm a feminist, but...
The Guilty Feminist is the award-winning live comedy podcast from me, Deborah Frances White, which explores our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. Previous guests include Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Hannah Gadsby, Sindhu V, Emma Thompson, and many more. To listen, just search for Guilty Feminist wherever you get your podcasts. And to get tickets for the live show, go to guiltyfeminist.com.
Okay, so you said, you know, you're a social psychologist and your research really sits at the intersection of these two things, right? Of psychology and sexuality. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about like a time or like a story or an example where a psychological theory or concept really shed some unexpected light on human sexual behavior that you find really fascinating or think is really interesting.
So in thinking about how to answer this question, right? When I'm thinking about psychological theories and the insights that they lead us to, they're often insights that are predictable on the basis of that theory. And so usually when we're testing theory, we're finding things that confirm it. And the things that have been most surprising in terms of like uncovering new insights into human sexuality, in my view, haven't necessarily been from testing a theory. They've been from simply asking a question for the first time and gathering data, because I think that's what tends to surprise us most often, is because we all have these ideas about sex and what other people are doing. But unless we actually have the data to say what they're doing, then, you know, we don't really know what the truth is. So I'll give you a couple of quick examples of how just asking the question is sometimes the most surprising thing. So if you look at Alfred Kinsey's work in the 1940s and 50s, you know, at that time, societal attitudes towards sex were pretty negative, right? And the idea was that sex should only happen within marriage for the purpose of making babies, right? And you shouldn't be gay, and, you know, you shouldn't be doing anything other than just having sex for procreation. But when Kinsey conducted his research, he found that, you know, actually lots of people have same-sex attraction and are engaging in same-sex behavior. Women are masturbating. Gasp. You know, it's like finding all of these things, right? And, you know, it was actually Kinsey's research about women that created the real political firestorm, because it was one thing for him to say, you know, men are having sex outside of marriage and visiting sex workers. But when you say women are masturbating and having lesbian experiences, that was something that was just totally different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was one case where just asking the questions just sent these shockwaves off. Now, if you jump ahead in time to the 1990s, that was when we got our first ever nationally representative survey of sexual behavior in the US. Kinsey's work was not nationally representative. He could only interview the people that he could find who were willing to talk about sex in the 40s and 50s. So it was limited in some ways. But in the 90s, the government, US government, was going to give money to do this nationally representative sex survey for the first time. And kind of at the last minute, US Congress pulled the funding for it because they were afraid that when they did the sex study in the 90s, that they were going to find even more depraved, if you will, results than what Kinsey found, and that we're all perverts, and, you know, that people were much more hypersexual than we thought that they were. And so they ended up rescinding funding for this. And so the people who were going to do the research had to go to private sources to try to get money so they could still do the work. They ended up doing it on a smaller scale than they wanted, but it was still nationally representative. And what they actually found was that people were actually surprisingly sexually conservative. And they found that estimates of same-sex behavior and gay and lesbian identities were lower than what Kinsey had projected, that people weren't having as much sex as everybody thought that they were. And so, you know, it's funny that, you know, conservatives were so concerned about this sex study happening because they thought that, you know, it was going to be a second coming of like Kinsey's findings. But in reality, it was actually, hey, we're more conservative than people thought. Now, one last data point, you know, if you jump ahead another 30 years to the National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior, like what are people doing today sexually? You know, you might think that if you look at sexual attitudes, you know, based on what the Gallup opinion polls say, like people are more supportive than ever of sex outside of marriage and same-sex relations and same-sex marriage and divorce and all these other sorts of things. You might think that people were, you know, even more sexually active today than they were in the 90s, but we actually aren't. You know, we're actually living in the least sexually active generation that's kind of ever existed. And so it's kind of like this weird thing that when we go out and we ask the questions, that's where we often find these counterintuitive things. Like despite all we hear every day in the media about hookup culture, it's like, no, teens today are actually less likely to have sex. They're having sex with fewer partners than they were in the past and with lower frequency. It's true for people across genders, people single and in relationships, like we're all fucking less than we were. And so to me, that's always been where the surprise is like looking at what's our expectation, what do we think people are doing versus what's the reality by asking the questions. And that's where the surprises are.
So interesting. I mean, for the piece on the 90s, like when people were kind of not or sharing results that I guess were unexpected, do you kind of anticipate that because of stigma at that time around like identifying as queer, talking about queer acts, that people weren't reporting kind of accurate data? Or what do you think about that?
Well, we got to consider it was a different period in time in a lot of ways. And it was also kind of like coming off the peak of the AIDS epidemic in the late 80s and early 90s. And so there was this huge stigma attached to homosexuality, especially male homosexuality. And so and that also just created a lot of fear with regard to sex, because here there was this STD that we didn't really have an effective treatment for. There was no cure for it or anything like that. And so, you know, it was this time of great cultural conservatism when it came to sexual attitudes. And I think it had a lot to do with the sort of, you know, let me rephrase that. So I think it had a lot to do with the fact that when it comes to sexual attitudes, there's always this ebb and flow. There's this pendulum that swings back and forth. You know, the 60s and 70s were the sexual revolution and the free love era and this time of sexual exploration. But in the 80s and 90s, there was this big contraction. You know, the pendulum swung the other way toward more conservatism. And then, you know, in the early aughts, we kind of had a shift more towards sexual liberalism, and we started to have these more expansive ideas of sexuality and gender. But suddenly we find ourselves again in the midst of this conservative pendulum shift.
Swing. And so that's interesting.
That's why we need to keep studying sex at all these different points in time. We can't just look at one set of findings from the past and think that it applies today, because we're always in the midst of some pendulum shift. And the one that we're in right now, I don't really know when it's going to end and when we're going to go back the other way, because it's a little scary in some ways.
Wow. So interesting. We got to have you on another time to talk about Gen Z and other folks having less sex. But for now, we are going to transition into a segment that we have called The Buzz. And this is where we get a guest take on a trendy sex topic, something that's popular, something that people are chatting about. And today we're talking about threesomes. So, Justin, you've written before, you know, about how even though having a threesome is the most popular fantasy, potentially, it's also the fantasy that is least likely to turn out well when people act on it. So we have kind of a bunch of questions off of that. The first one is, why do you think threesomes are such a popular fantasy? And why does expectation rarely meet the reality of having a threesome?
So in terms of why threesomes are a popular fantasy, there are a couple of reasons. One is that part of the appeal is just the novelty element. So having another person, another set of genitals around, right? It's a way, it's an easy way of kind of amplifying the excitement factor, right? In some ways, it's sort of like the laziest fantasy you could have, because it's like, let me picture sex with another person and then, oh, let's bring another person into the mix, right? Okay. So it's just a quick way to kind of titillate and add novelty. But it's more than that, because when I look at the way people describe their threesome fantasies, more often than not, they want to be the center of attention in it. And so there's sort of this element of wanting to be wanted, or wanting to be desired, or overwhelmingly desired by multiple people at once, because it's validating and it can sort of tap into feelings of sexual self-confidence. And then, of course, you know, there can be other things going on depending on how your threesome fantasy plays out. You know, for example, a lot of heterosexual men will have a fantasy about a threesome with two other women, and like the sort of sexual interaction between the two women might be the really arousing part for him. And so it's kind of like there's this voyeuristic fantasy of kind of watching lesbian sex that kind of might be part of the threesome. So, you know, the appeal of it might be different for different people, but those are some common reasons. And in terms of why threesome fantasies don't always live up to expectations, well, it goes back to what we were saying earlier, that the way we picture the fantasy going in our head doesn't always map out to how it goes in reality. And with something like a threesome, all right, let's say you get three people together, they all want to have a threesome, but they all have different fantasies for how the threesome should go, and they haven't communicated about that beforehand. Well, that's where things start to get complicated and messy. Like, let's say they all thought they were going to be the center of attention, but how does that work?
Everyone's just laying there like ready.
Right. No, you do something. Right. No, you do something. Right. So that's one of the cases where it can get tricky. Another is that many cases I've heard from people who've had threesomes that have not worked out are like, they were out at a bar with their partner and they started talking to some attractive stranger. And the next thing they know, after a lot of drinks, they're all in bed together. They haven't communicated about it beforehand. They haven't set the boundaries even with their own partner on like what is and isn't allowed. Right. And so it's like, it's oftentimes those communication issues where they don't realize till they're in the heat of the moment, like, oh, we needed a boundary there.
Right. Yeah. Would you say like, if a monogamous couple or a monogamish couple, however they identify, is interested in having a threesome, would it behoove them prior to that ever happening, maybe asking each other a couple questions of like, how do you picture this? What, you know, what are your boundaries? What are kind of the acts that we're comfortable with? Is there kind of a guide that you would give people on this?
Yeah. So if you and your partner are interested in exploring it, you know, a good starting point is just asking, what is it that's hot to you or arousing to you about having a threesome? And just hearing them describe that is going to clue you into kind of maybe how they picture or want the scenario to go, or what they're really hoping to get out of it. So, you know, that can be a starting point, but then you also need to talk about, all right, what are our boundaries or limits? Are there any sexual activities or behaviors that we aren't allowed to do with the third person? And what are the requirements for us in terms of like safe sex and sexual health protection? So what are we going to do to minimize our risk of contracting STIs? And what is our testing schedule going to be if we're going to be regularly bringing other people into the mix? So it's just having a conversation about, what do you want out of this experience? And what should those limits sort of be on the situation? And then before you get to the point of like actually having a threesome, you might want to try a few practice things first. So maybe, for example, it's just you and your partner going out and flirting with somebody else together in person and just kind of like seeing how that goes, right? So instead of committing to like, let's bring somebody else into bed right now, it's like, let's just see what the dynamic or interaction is if we're just kind of being a little bit playful with another person in a social setting. Because if that brings up insecurity or jealousy, like you've got your red flags going off already, right?
That you need to go
back and communicate about this more beforehand and make sure that it's right for you.
Totally. Yeah, that's such a good idea. And our last question on this is, are there any kind of specific resources or kind of like networks available for individuals or couples interested in exploring threesomes? I feel like the logistical piece of this is the thing that a lot of people have trouble with. So I'm wondering, you know, where do people find other people who are interested?
Yeah. So in terms of just like general resources, if you want more information on threesome, you can check out my book, Tell Me What You Want, and my Sex and Psychology podcast. I've done quite a few episodes on threesomes and how to navigate them and things that you need to know there. But in terms of, all right, you've read the information, you're ready to go find a third partner. How do you do that? Right. And, you know, maybe it's not just that you're in a couple relationship and you're looking for a third. Maybe you're a single person and you're looking for a couple, or maybe you're just looking for three people who can get together. Maybe none of you are in relationships, right? Where do you go? Well, there are a few apps that kind of cater more toward people who are interested in non-monogamy or multi-partner sex. One of them would be a place called Feeld, F-E-E-L-D, where you can go and you can express interest in something like a threesome and find like-minded people. Because sometimes if you go to kind of like the mainstream dating sites, like if you're going on Match.com and your profile's like looking for threesome, you know, you might not get a lot of hits. It might not be sort of the right place for that. You might need to go toward a more sex positive community where it kind of selects for an audience or crowd of people who are more open-minded and more sex positive in that way. So yeah, maybe try some different kinds of dating apps. Threesomes can also happen in person. Sometimes they happen organically. They can happen between friends, right? So it kind of depends on your own sort of friendship network and circle. But so they don't just have to be facilitated online, but maybe it's something else if you're going out and meeting the right people, that can kind of happen too.
Thank you so much for talking with me about threesomes. That's amazing. I love hearing all this information. And yeah, love to hear how it kind of relates to people's fantasies and how it actually plays out in real life, which could be two different things. Now we're going to move on to our final segment called Booty Call, where we share followers' sex stories or ask for advice and hot takes. And so we are going to play that clip, and then we're just going to talk about it and, you know, give some advice if needed and just hear what this follower has to say.
Hi, DB. I'd love some advice on navigating a situation I've been dealing with lately. I struggle with body image issues, and it's really starting to affect my confidence in the bedroom. I just don't feel as comfortable or sexy in my own skin as I'd like to. And I was wondering if you could offer some advice or tips on how I can start feeling better about myself and build up that confidence in my sex life. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thanks so much. Love the podcast.
All right. So that was actually our producer, Sadie, reading someone else's message that they left. They wrote into us. And so that was the question or the booty call. And so clearly, whoever wrote in here, you know, is sharing that they aren't as comfortable as they would like to be. And it sounds like kind of what I said in the beginning of the episode here around, I really wish that people felt super, you know, good about their bodies. That in sex ed, if that person was there, would have felt really good. But it seems like where we're at now is maybe this person needs a little bit of help figuring out how to feel better in their body. So what would you say to this person who wrote in?
Well, first I would say that this is a very common concern, right? Body image issues. Actually, they're surprisingly common across gender and sexual orientation and can have significant implications for people's intimate lives. Oftentimes, if we're not feeling very comfortable or confident in our own skin, it can make us hard for us to be in the mood for sex, let alone to even enjoy it, because then we find ourselves engaging in what sex therapists call spectatoring, where we're sort of like mentally stepping out and kind of critically looking at ourselves. And that can really get in the way of having a healthy sex life. So a couple of things that you can do here. One is to try engaging in body appreciation exercises, right? So sometimes it's just a matter of finding a way to just get more comfortable and confident in our own skin. And there are lots of ways that you can do this. You know, one of the most commonly recommended ways is you just start by spending a few minutes in front of a mirror every day naked, and you're just looking at one thing you can find on your body that you like or appreciate, and focusing on that. And then it kind of expands and goes from there. And it can be anything as small as you want. Maybe you love your eyebrows. Maybe you love, you know, this little mole or freckle or something that you have on your side. You know, it doesn't have to be any, you know, it doesn't have to be like right away, like start with loving and appreciating your entire body, right? Because that's hard to do and it's unrealistic, but it's just sort of starting small and then progressively working up from there. Another thing is maybe it's asking yourself, well, have I always had this anxiety or concern about my body, or is this something new? And what might it be that's going on here? So, for example, sometimes maybe when we're younger, we didn't have many body image concerns, but we developed them later in life as our bodies changed or as something happened to our bodies along the way. And, you know, it's going to be different for different people, and we can't always change some of the things back to the way that they were before, right? And so, but then that still gets to this question or issue of maybe body appreciation can be a way of sort of working through that. So what is it that you're uncomfortable with? Why? And how can we focus on just sort of learning to love ourselves as we are? Again, it's much easier said than done.
Right.
And sometimes, in some cases, it really works best in conjunction with a sex therapist who can kind of help us to work through and unpack some of the complex issues that might be going on behind it, because sometimes there might be deeper issues that are going on here as well.
Absolutely. I love this advice. The mirror thing is exactly what I was going to say. I think like that is a tangible thing that someone can do to really recognize that it takes practice to really love ourselves and to say those things out loud and to talk about them if you have a partner or partners. I think that really understanding that practice eventually leads to potentially you believing that, even if it's really hard for you to believe that, it's really important. So nobody, you know, is perfect, and everybody at one point in time has had one thing or many things that they don't like about their body. But today's a great day to start practicing loving yourself and to really recognize all the wonderful things about you. Yeah.
If there's one thing that I can also add to that, it's to also learn how to accept compliments from other people, right? Because when we have body image anxiety, oftentimes we'll just totally dismiss nice things that other people might say to us about our appearance because we attribute them to, you know, maybe they were just being nice or maybe they're lying. And so then we don't even get the benefit of feeling that compliment. And, you know, something that might be helpful in some cases is when you get these compliments, maybe it's even sort of writing them down or keeping a record of them, that you have something that you can go back to and say, you know, this person said this nice thing about, you know, the way I look. And like, this is the proof, like the validation. Maybe my perception doesn't line up with the way that other people see me. You know, there was a point in my own life where I kind of like went through some body image issues. And it was actually literally this thing of kind of like keeping this log of like things people said to me.
Compliment note.
I know it was sort of like that. And it sounds stupid. And like,
I think it's great.
Some people might think it sounds desperate, dumb, whatever. But for me, it worked because it was like, hey, I really had a hard time taking or accepting compliments from other people. And once I had enough data, I was like, all right, all of these people can't be conspiring against me to lie to make me feel good. Like, it's just not possible.
Totally.
And that was sort of the turning point for me, that it was like, okay, maybe they're seeing something that I'm not. And that kind of helped me have that sort of shift in appreciating my own appearance.
Love it. I love this compliment note idea. This is so wonderful. You're so fucking cool. I'm really, really honored to have you on the podcast, Justin. So thank you so, so much for joining us. And yeah, you rock. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our creator, host, and executive producer is me, Danielle Bezalow. Our communications lead is Catherine Cohen. Our producer is Sadie Leegee. Our marketing coordinator is Mitch Coburn. Our social media coordinator is M. Kirsty Frazier. Our music theme is by Hook Sounds. Thanks so much to our featured guests, partners, and listeners. Want to partner with us? Email us at sexedwithdb@gmail.com. Do you have a silly sex story to share, need some advice, or have thoughts on the episode you just heard? Give us a booty call for a chance to be featured on the podcast. Check the show notes for the details. For more sex ed content, follow us on IG at sexedwithdbpodcast and on TikTok at sexedwithdb. Want to know your sex toy zodiac sign? Go to our link tree on our IG now. See you next time.